This podcast is brought to you by MyScore IQ. MyScore IQ services are here to help you be prepared when it comes to making big financial decisions, such as buying or refinancing your home or purchasing that new car. Try it out for only $1 for a 7-day trial. You'll receive your FICO scores from all three major credit bureaus, along with active credit report monitoring and alerts for changes to your credit report and possible suspicious activity.
MyScore IQ services can help you be in the best position possible when you take that step to apply for a home or auto loan, all for $1 for a 7-day trial. Visit MyScoreIQ.com/Todd to learn more. That's MyScoreIQ.com/Todd.
Welcome back to the Talking Stocks podcast. It's what we do. Joe and Todd with you here as always. Todd, how are you doing? Spring is here. Things are looking up.
Yeah, I'm starting to see some things coming out of the ground that are green.
Yes.
The sun is shining and Joe just got his second shot, his first shot.
First shot. Yeah. Don't want to rush things, but yes, I got my first shot today at a clinic run by the University of New Hampshire. So got the Moderna shot. My arm's, you know, a little sore. I definitely felt a little weird after getting it, but nothing crazy. You know, I don't have a big rash on my shoulder or anything. So I've been told the first 24 hours can be a little bit uncertain. I'm not expecting to feel 100% tomorrow, but that's okay. I can sacrifice that to not spread this virus anymore.
That's right. I got mine. As we talked about, and a week ago, I think all I had was some random shivers. I was pretty much unaffected by it, but I guess the real test is the second one, maybe you feel a bit more like junk than the first one. But I won't be able to update, you know, listeners on that for a few more weeks. But it is good to see that they're opening it up more now. And actually being able to do it right there on the university campus is a pretty convenient, great setup. They had a lot of people there.
Yeah, it was easy to get in and out. So I mean, there wasn't a line out the door or anything. But yeah, I mean, all of the stations that had nurses at them had people sitting down getting their shots. So great. Yeah, plenty of traffic in and out. So hopefully they can set up a couple more of those, get the whole student body immunized, and yeah, we can stop being super spreaders like they've been calling us on the media.
And then hopefully we all start to get back a little bit back to normal. I mean, we're still gonna have to be cautious, obviously, but a little bit back to normal would be good.
I would like, yeah, I'm optimistic for sure,
and certainly stocks are optimistic. I, you know, some of these stocks in the reopening plays have just been monstrous. I mean, you look at some of these leisure stocks, hotel stocks, travel stocks. I was looking at airlines the other day and just going, wow, some of these airlines have absolutely just tripled from their low and are now higher than they were pre-COVID. And I thought that was really interesting. And I was thinking about it and talking with somebody else about that the other day. And one of the things that you know, I think we should remember is that a lot of capacity got, you know, stuck at the end of the runway. I mean, they just parked a lot of planes.
That's right.
You know, there were some routes where maybe you had four or five routes a day, but now there's only like one or two. So they've got some pricing power. So if they can get butts in seats and, you know, ramp up a little bit those airline tickets, I mean, theoretically, yeah, you could see a pretty good run. You know, obviously we have to worry a little bit about jet fuel costs with rising oil, but, you know, typically, I mean, to some extent, I think those are going to get passed on. So.
Yeah, for sure. I'm actually going to be doing a little bit of traveling in a couple of weeks, going down to visit some folks in South Carolina, and didn't really expect it. But when I went to book my flight, it was really expensive. It was like $350 or $380 something round trip on Spirit. I was shocked. It was weird though. I wonder if that's like, if the week that I'm going, it's like a week and a half from today, flying down on a Monday. I wonder if that's like some holiday or vacation week that I don't know about. I guess that would be like April vacation for schools, but yeah, it was very strange. It was like that one week was just way more expensive than the others.
Yeah, so it's probably like the April vacation seems like they always would increase that. So I wonder if the timing of it is a little bit off. But, you know, I was looking at, I mean, it's all over the board, but I feel like, I don't feel like they're significantly cheaper. So I, you know, I was like, there are some inexpensive flights if you can be flexible, but.
You hear the stories about, like, one of my cousins was telling me he booked a trip to Florida, and I think the round trip flight was like $17. That was not that long ago either. That was maybe 2 months ago. So I was not expecting it to be as expensive as it was. But anyway, that's
So I think from investors are definitely going to want to pay attention to capacity.
Oh yeah,
load factor, and fortunately, those statistics, if you Google them, you can find them pretty readily. I think maybe the Bureau of Transportation actually publishes them on a pretty regular basis. It's been a little bit since I actually had to look up that data, so I don't know off the top of my head, but if we Google it, we can keep track of it. And certainly going to be something to watch. I mean, I was looking at some of the higher scoring stocks in the travel space, and you know, looking at one of them, Booking, BKNG, which is the old Priceline, and I was like, geez, wow, this is like almost at all-time highs. You know, not much of a bargain now, but at the same time, you know, the comparisons are going to be a lot easier. You know, one of the other things too, Joe, that was interesting, we've been talking for a few months about how easy comparisons may be in 2021 because of 2020, you know, the shutdown. But I think at some point in the next 6 months, we're going to have to start saying, you know what, 2022 is going to have some pretty tough comparisons, because you're not going to have, theoretically, you're not going to have two different $3 trillion bills going through Congress, you know, theoretically, right? You know, so you're not going to have the same kind of amount of stimulus, and, you know, people will bounce back, and maybe, you know, it'll swing back, the pendulum will swing back more towards normal. And obviously we're going to want to start to position our portfolios then, if that's true, then we're probably going to want to start making those decisions in September or October, ahead of 2022, a few months ahead of 2022.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see what happens in 2022 after this year, assuming that the GDP growth projections are around what we've been hearing, in the neighborhood of 4 to 6 or 7%. You know, what the heck happens after that? That is like, that's a booming year. And so wouldn't surprise me to see a little bit of a pullback in 2022. But yeah,
that's a pretty good segue to the
I was waiting for the segue, and here it is. So take it away, Todd. You found an interesting little study this week, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, I love FinTwit, because you know, if you've curated your Twitter feed pretty well, you can find people post some really interesting stuff. And one of the things that I saw and show up in my feed was, I think it was from 2015 or 2016. So it was a little dated, but it was a few years back. But it was Robert Frey, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, but he's a mathematician who was a managing partner, I believe, at Renaissance with Jim Simons, who's a legendary investor, and Renaissance is a legendary, you know, hedge fund. And he was speaking in front of a group in France, and he was talking about drawdowns. You know, how long should investors expect in their average lifespan to be underwater in their investment accounts based on history? And, you know, I think one of the things that got him thinking about that, you know, I'm not going to speak for him, but my takeaway from watching the YouTube video, and anybody who wants to see that video can simply go to my Twitter feed at EB Capital on Twitter, and just scroll down on my tweets, and you'll see that the link to that, watch that. But anyways, I think that he was probably thinking about, well, this is a pretty unique period of time that we've been in these last few years, and I wonder how unique this period is, and I wonder if people are making a mistake in extrapolating, say, a 3 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 year period, in saying, okay, now I have enough experience in the markets, I know what to expect, this is how it should be from here. And lo and behold, I mean, his findings on drawdowns fascinated me. And it just, I wanted to bring it up in our chat, because the number, the sheer percentage of time that his studies suggested the average investor will be underwater was quite eye-opening to me. And Joe, I think I may have already told you the number, so I won't leave the I won't ask you necessarily for the number, but listeners, think in your head over an average lifetime how much time you might think you would spend underwater on your investments.
Just to clarify too, this is not saying that if you invest $5,000 now and let it ride, that in 20 years you're gonna have less than $5,000. That's not what we mean. It's more over a particular period of time. So if you were to picture a timeline and you slice it in two places, though, regardless of what's in between those two places, what percentage of the time you will have lost money.
Right, right.
I hope I explained that in a cohesive way.
Yeah, I know.
Because I've seen this maybe a little bit woozy.
It's wonky. Yeah. To go back, what he did is he looked at 180 years, a small sample, 180 years of data. So he used a synthetic S&P because the S&P 500 didn't get founded until I think 1951 or something like that. So, you know, prior to that, though, you could figure out what companies would probably be in the S&P. So there's the synthetic you were able to use and create to kind of track this. So he took this 180 years and he kind of crunched the numbers on it. And one of the things that he found was that, well, yeah, if you look at a chart starts at 1830 and goes through 2015 or whatever, you look very smart for buying and holding, right? I mean, you know, that stretch of time, that line is nice and sharply higher up to the right. Like you said, those two points in time. But then when you start looking, zooming in on that, you can find some interesting observations, including that the vast majority of the gains are made in very short periods of time. And that the majority of time, you're actually just treading water sideways or you're down from the prior peak. So you've gone up and then you're sideways and then, or maybe you trickle down and then maybe you'll go up for a few years and then you'll sideways and down. And the actual percentage of time that you're in a drawdown is 75%.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And now that to me, living and really, really getting into investing from, you know, my career started in 97. So really ramped up my investment activity into that 2000. So 2000 through 2010, that rings very true to me. Like I can thinking at it and just how brutal that period was. You'd have these sharp moves up and it would get you all in and then you'd sideways out or you drop down. You had 08, you had 03 or 04, you had 01, in the drop after the dot-com bust. So it was like, oh, wow, yeah, there's some brutal periods. And then even if you look out at certain individual stocks, you could say, oh, wow, like Cisco in 1999, still, I mean, it may even still be underwater to its peak in 1999, 20 years later. If not, it's just barely above it. Corning still below it. A lot of stocks still below it 20 years later. So 75% of the time you're in drawdown. And I thought that was interesting because it made me think of a couple different things. One, you know, we better make sure we don't extrapolate what we've seen the last couple of years and assume that this is the way it's going to be. There's probably going to be some periods of disappointment. And he calls them states of regret, I think he called them.
States of regret, is that? So,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, something like that, where you're just looking at that prior peak. And I think his point was that, you know, when we invest typically for a purpose. Right, we're saving for a house, or we're saving for some event, or we're saving for retirement, and so you have these periods of regret where you're getting closer and closer over time to wherever that event is that you would need the money, and you're looking at your account and you're below that prior peak still, right? So I think there were a few different takeaways. Don't let's not extrapolate too far into the future what we've experienced this great market the last few years. Two, it helps to look at a much larger time period to kind of understand the markets and how the markets might behave. And Joe, I can already hear our listeners saying, yeah, but Todd, yeah, but, right? You had, you know, everything changed after the Federal Reserve was created after the Great Depression, or the world was very different in the pre-World War II versus post-World War II. Yes, he's a mathematician. He figured all that. He looked at the various periods, and sure enough, it held true. And that makes sense to us. You know, I mean, seasonality is a part of our research for a reason. And that's that, you know, you can try to argue that this time is different, but the reality is that while times may be different, our reaction and our behavior in those times is similar. So it's the Twainism, right? History may not repeat, but it rhymes. And, you know, you could make the argument, well, when the horse and buggy went to the automobile, you know, that was a seismic change. You know, all of these periods felt like seismic, this time is different changes, right? So I think that you can still look at that larger swath of time and come away with some takeaways. The other takeaway that I had on it was that it kind of speaks to the value in dollar cost averaging, because you can take advantage of that drawdown to be buying and buying and buying steadily every month a certain amount of money. And then when you do get those short bursts, and when I say short bursts, I mean, we're in one of them now that you could argue started in 2000, you know, whenever we eclipsed the 2007 high, you know, 6 or 7 years or whatever that was. So, I mean, they can last pretty extended periods of time, but in the grand scheme of things, relatively short periods of time. So the dollar cost averaging, I think that was the other takeaway that I had, was that it makes a lot of sense, you know, to continually be trafficking in the market a little bit every single period of time. So anyways, I just wanted to kick off the discussion today with that, because I thought it was a fascinating, and anyway, and if anybody's interested, they can watch the discussion of it just by simply going to my Twitter page.
Absolutely. All right. So with that, I want to pivot to a couple of questions we've gotten in the YouTube comments. For those of you who left these, sorry, I kind of fell behind on these. One of these, I think, is from like 2 weeks ago. So my apologies. But I want to get started with this one. This is a deep one, Todd. I'm not going to read this whole thing. But Shoeless Joe, good name, by the way, asks about a company called Ascensus Surgical, ASXC. So basically I was wondering if you could possibly do an update on a company called Intuitive Surgical and their competitors. So for those of you who don't know, Todd used to be on a podcast for The Motley Fool where they covered healthcare. And also Todd has done a lot of healthcare related writing for The Motley Fool over the years. So this Shoeless Joe is a longtime follower of Todd's. So moving forward, he's wondering if you could do an update on Intuitive Surgical since Transcenterix, I have no idea, I'm just going to move on, have gotten FDA approval for their new surgical robot with haptic feedback and eye/camera control with the new company name Ascensus Surgical, ASXC. I feel like there could be some potential in this penny stock, especially since hospitals are forced to pay some pretty exorbitant costs to keep the robot in operation. There you go. It's a meaty question, Todd.
It is. Okay, so I'm going to paraphrase that. You know, what are my current thoughts of an Intuitive Surgical, and do I think that
right? It's a bit of a niche stock. We were doing a little digging before we started recording, and we figured out that they have about $1 million in quarterly revenue. So yeah,
this is definitely not a stock for the faint of heart. So Intuitive Surgical makes surgical robots that helps to automate using minimally invasive surgery, helps to automate the surgical procedure. It's used in things like hernias and prostate and gynecological procedures, that type of thing. And the whole idea is here that you get faster, better outcomes, quicker recovery times, because you're having the surgeon sit and use controllers, and any hand movements are actually smoothed out by the actual machine that's doing the cutting and the sewing and the surgery itself. So picture a surgeon sitting in behind a almost like a computer screen, really, with these very sophisticated handles that they're able to use to manage this robot arms to do the surgeries. And this is very, very common, very widely deployed. There are thousands of these machines that are set up in hospitals worldwide, and they're cranking out a significant number of procedures and more procedures. Every couple of years, they add a new procedure to the list that qualify for use with it. So I am a big fan, long-term fan and long-term shareholder, Intuitive Surgical, because I really do believe that the future of surgery is going to be some form of automation. You know, it's having an individual surgeon performing each individual surgery, even it just doesn't seem like it makes the most sense. Like it doesn't seem to me that that's the way that the market's going to go. It Intuitive Surgical is in a weird spot right now. It's actually only neutral rated, Joe, in the research right now. It's only like a 70, I think is the score. And I want to pull up, I'm just going to pull up my screen so people can take a look at this and see, share my screen. I want to take a look at the chart and talk a little bit about the sales and the earnings for the company. And Joe, you can see I've got Ascensus up right now, but I'm actually going to swap that out and I'm going to change that chart to show Intuitive Surgical. ISRG is the symbol there. And you can see it's been kind of going sideways since last July or August. And one of the reasons for that, Joe, is that, I mean, as you can imagine, with COVID, a lot of elective surgeries have been put off. And a lot of the surgeries that Intuitive Surgical is done for are elective. So procedure volume overall has been lackluster relative to, you know, past procedure levels. And system sales have been flattened out too, because, you know, hospitals have really, since they're not pushing a lot of people through for these surgeries, there's not a lot of incentive in spending a couple million dollars, which is what these machines cost, to deploy another one of these machines within in their hospital. And as you can see in the chart, you know, revenue in the December quarter only up 4% year over year. What I do think is interesting about this, Joe, is that from here, I think it's going to be more of an earnings per share story for Intuitive Surgical than a revenue story, because they have reached some level of penetration. Like I said, these are pretty well deployed. They're expensive. They're, you know, most of the major hospital systems have access to one of them already. So, you know, the systems themselves, probably you're going to see a depressed number of sales of those anyways. And that means that most of the revenue is going to come from disposable pieces that are used on the machines from every surgery. So with each procedure, some of the stuff you can't reuse, you have to throw that out. Guess who you have to buy it from? You have to buy it from Intuitive Surgical, right? The upside to that is that the margin on those disposables is better than it is on these big machines.
Of course, it's like a printer cartridge.
Exactly. Exactly. So the whole idea here is that you get the machine deployed, and then where you really start to make the profit is on selling of the disposables. I think you can see that if you just look at, you know, we had the 4% year over year revenue growth in the quarter, but then you look at the earnings expected earnings growth over the next 2 years, and it's 22% in 21 and 23% in 22. So I think that from here, the big story for Intuitive Surgical is going to be, okay, do procedure volumes bounce back with a more vaccinated population that's getting back to normal, going to seeing primary cares, getting referred out to specialists who then would, you know, recommend these surgical interventions. If procedures do bounce back pretty rapidly, then I think that there's a very good argument here for to buy this company on earnings expansion. I don't really expect, though, this to be a double-digit revenue growth story. I guess I would be happily surprised if it was, only because I think that you're going to see a lot of these hospital systems get a little tight-fisted in spending over the course of the next, yeah, I think that tight fist would probably be hold up for the next 12, 18 months. So Intuitive Surgical, I like it. It's neutral in our research. I happen to be a shareholder. I've owned it for years. I think probably the way to approach it would be to say, if it breaks out to a new high, if our score gets back above an 85, 90, then yeah, you could go out and buy this if you don't own it. Otherwise, I would just sit and watch and wait and see how the procedure volume trends look. And then if you go back to the actual company that the listener was listening to, Ascensus, which used to be Transcendentrix, which is just an impossible name to say. This is a stock that has made and lost a lot of investors' money over the years, because there's always been hype about it. That people thought that when it won approval for it, that mid-sized and small-sized hospitals would flock to it because the machine is cheaper than Intuitive Surgical's, and it has a little bit, the argument is it has more haptic feedback, meaning the surgeon can actually feel what it's doing more in the hands. So that was the bull argument. The reality, though, in my view, is this is now a show me state stock. You know, you've been on the market for a few years. You really haven't gotten any traction. Last in the December quarter, your sales were 1 million. You have a 600 million market cap already. So while we say penny stock, you know, 600 million market cap with a 4 million annualized run rate, you know, you need a lot to go right from here for Ascensus. So I'm going to call this a show me state stock. It's not something that I would be interested in buying with my money. I would much rather wait and see if Intuitive Surgical busts back out and scores improve. And that's the one I would focus on.
Yeah, there are certainly plenty of better scoring healthcare stocks out there, even if you were to narrow it down to just medical devices. So moving on, we have another question from Pavel B, who I believe has asked us a couple of questions before. So thank you, Pavel. Keep it coming. He says, just an idea to discuss next week. If we got an overshot in inflation, how would markets, especially tech, react to this? And what would it take to get Todd to reduce tech weighting in his portfolio to low double-digit allocation? Which, boy, is that a loaded question.
Oh, geez, Pavel, putting me on the spot with this question. This is a tough one. You and I were chatting a little bit before the show started, and we're just kind of going over some of the puts and the takes of, in, you know, what happens when you get inflation periods and everything. You know, I think on Shoujo a month ago, I don't remember what it was, the weeks they blur, but we shared that business cycle chart.
Yep.
You know, where it showed that the best period for technology stocks is early cycle expansion. There's no real bad period, according to this Fidelity study that we had shared with listeners on a prior episode, but that they definitely do best in that early and then the very beginning of the maturing of that business cycle. You could argue that right now we're in that maturing stage. And I think I've said on the show a few times at this point that I'm modeling and moving my portfolio more towards mid and late stage, trying to get it out in front of inflation. So the question then becomes, okay, if Todd's assuming that there's gonna be inflation, we are moving later cycle, at what point would Todd say, geez, you know, having such a huge amount of technology exposure doesn't make a lot of sense? That's a tough one. And I guess, you know, I hate to be cagey about it. Price would probably inform my decision, Joe. And by that, I simply mean that, you know, our scores in our research model have price volume components to it, short-term and a long-term. And as long as the short and the long-term stay okay, well, you could lose the short-term and still be all right long-term. But if that long-term goes negative, that indicator, that would be on the basket, that would get me very nervous. By nature, I don't like owning stocks unless I have high conviction. Like if it's a Costco or if it's Intuitive Surgical or something that I've call, you know, as you know, Joe, I have forever stocks and rentals. And when I say forever, I don't necessarily mean forever. I just mean I have no intention to sell them. I don't care if those go below the 200 moving average, but generally speaking, I don't really like to add new stocks to my portfolio if they're trading below the 200 moving average. So just naturally, as I'm selling some things and I'm removing other things and looking to buy new things, I probably would end up with a lower exposure to technology pretty naturally, because I wouldn't be adding those technology as new stocks. You know, it's a loaded question. There's so many pieces to it. And the other thing I was thinking of too is, I mean, I've been creating these scores for over 17 years. So I've seen, you know, a lot of really interesting markets. And even in those really bad markets of say 08, 09, there were always still a few technology stocks that screened well and that I could go out and own and buy. And I am a growth investor at heart, but I am pivoting, as I've talked about on the show before. I am pivoting and including more things in my portfolio that are less the high growth tech and more, you know, these mid and late stage, you know, kind of inflation oriented plays. So, you know, some of the industrials and some of the consumers, some healthcare, not as much healthcare because we still haven't seen that score pop up in our research much, but, you know, tucking certain things in, like we talked about Henry Sheen last week's show, HSIC, I picked some of that up this week, added to the portfolio. So I guess I don't have a great answer. There's no one particular thing that would make me go, I need to get out of all my tech stocks today. It would probably just be more natural progression that as I'm upgrading my portfolio, I would naturally end up with a lower weight of technology stocks because the rankings, our rankings wouldn't necessarily have as many at the top of them.
Right. Yeah. And another thing too, is that it really depends on your strategy. Like Todd, your strategy, you're obviously a very active trader. You make several trades a week. I would guess, if not dozens of trades a week. And that's obviously not realistic for most investors who are, you know, managing money in their IRA, 401k, brokerage account. So I, like, personally, from my perspective as more of a personal investor who's just investing my savings in my spare time, like, there's not really ever a reason to depart from high growth tech overall as a sector, because as we've said so many times before, even if it looks bearish in the near term, and even if that near term is the next 6 months, in another 2 years, it's probably going to be higher than it is right now anyway, because those companies are growing at such a quick rate. And there's nothing, the way I see it, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with any of these tech companies. Now, if something happened and suddenly it was clear that there was something wrong with, like, fundamentally with all software as a service companies or something like that, obviously that changes my opinion, and there are all sorts of extraneous factors that we can't predict. But generally speaking, if you're looking into the long term, say 2+ years, I don't really think there's ever a reason that you should adjust your allocation in that sort of way.
I think that if you're thinking long-term, you actually have to take a longer window, especially after the study that we led with on the fray.
Of course.
You know, you could just, I think that you have to actually say that, well, maybe over a 10-year period. I mean, but again, we looked at the Cisco example and the Corning example, and these are great businesses that grew. Their businesses were growing, but their stocks stayed down and underneath that prior peak for 20 years. So there's certainly, I think that there's the concept of buy and hold makes sense. In theory. In practice, obviously, you've got to look at each one of these individually and you know, figure out whether or not the opportunity cost associated with that money is too high, meaning that, you know, if you're going to have dead money in a particular stock, even though the business is doing better, but the stock is just going nowhere, could you make more money by buying something else? And the question then would be, well, is there something else that's emerging that isn't as well known or owned or heavily owned as Cisco was, say, in the early 2000s, emerging that you would rather put your money in? And I think that that's one of the things that I'm always doing with my portfolio. I don't like to call myself a trader. I guess I'm more active than many in that, you know, when I buy a stock, I do, some of them will be rentals. And when I say rental, I mean that, you know, I'm going to hold it until my catalyst passes. And that catalyst could be, if it's a biotech stock, it could be an FDA decision or a clinical trial readout, or it could be the energy stocks, which are cyclicals. And I'm buying them really just basically because I'm assuming inflation's going to go up. I don't plan on being married to these or having them be forever stocks. I usually don't day trade. I don't day trade. And I usually consider myself a position trader. Like, I have some stocks that I'm up thousands of percent on because I've owned them for years and years and years. So if I still believe in the story, I'll stick with it, but I am more active than many. And as a result, you know, I do end up, you will see the composition of my portfolio will change over time, probably more than some.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to put that. So I guess it's probably smattering time at this point, so we don't have a 2-hour episode that nobody will listen to. So I know you had a few ideas this week, so I'll let you take it away, Todd.
All right, great. So I'm going to open up my charts again. And Joe, just give me a thumbs up that you can see them. Listeners, obviously, if you're listening on one of the podcast platforms, we do put these up on YouTube under Limelight Alpha. So you could just Google it and watch these if you want to see what the charts and see how they look. These are all from this week's research. So I went through the large cap best and worst, the mid cap best and worst, and the small cap best and worst, looking for ideas. And I wanted to try find at least a few that we hadn't talked about on the show yet. So I've got about nine here that I want to mention. The first is MGPI. So MGPI, and that's MGP ingredients. And they do like distillery ingredients. So, you know, you've got these kind of craft brews. Well, think craft craft spirits. So they'll sell you the raw stuff that you need to make your vodkas, your gins, your bourbons, whatever. And they'll also do for regular food as well. And this is an interesting small cap stock. Grew 9% year over year in the December quarter, 14% year over year in the quarter before that. Has a $1.1 billion market cap and an annualized revenue run rate of $400 million. So not a bad price to sales ratio. Trading out $63 per share, earnings in 22 were supposed to grow 14% from 21. And I like the setup on it. You know, you pulled back to 58 from 72. You're kind of coming back up here, challenged the 50 and the 21 day. I think if you can eclipse the 50 day moving average here, somewhere around 65, this is one that you might want to stick in the portfolio. So that'd be number one. Number two, Construction Partners. And the symbol there is ROAD, R-O-A-D.
Good
and
symbol.
From the symbol, Joe, you can probably glean.
I can figure out your rationale behind this one. I certainly can.
Yes, provides construction products and service to public and private infrastructure projects, roads. So they help build roads. So again, if we're talking about a major infrastructure bill, then ROAD could benefit. You know, this company's got a $1.6 billion market cap, grew December quarter 9% year over year. In 21 and 22, you're looking at 17% and 19% EPS growth, respectively. And, you know, I like the technical setup. As you can see on the Market Smith chart here, we have a W overlay here. So you got a W setup and a challenging area at 30. I think you could actually take it here at the 30, and you could either stop out below it or just ride this thing out and see how the infrastructure treats it. So ROAD was one that I wanted to mention. Next one up is StoneX Group, Risk Management Securities Execution Commodity Trading Services. Interesting company, does not have great year-over-year revenue. Matter of fact, it's down 18% in the December quarter, but prior quarter is very strong, 27% year-over-year, 5%, and 183% because of some acquisitions. You have the stock breaking out to what looks like, I want to pull up the monthly chart here. Yeah, all-time highs, breaking out to all-time highs. In 2022, expected to earn, get this, Joe, $7.34 per share, currently trades at 66. So interesting company here in the finance area that people may want to consider. We talked a little bit about medical devices at the beginning of the show or earlier in the show. We were talking about Intuitive Surgical. Shockwave Medical just jumped into the best list this week after making a nice run after holding 100 and building up. It's challenging its old high of 144. It's currently at 138. And they've come up with a new device that can be used in clearing the calcium buildups that occur, the plaque that builds up in arteries. So it's kind of an improvement upon the existing way that people go about removing the calcification and getting the stents in. And it basically uses shockwaves to break up the calcium. So very interesting product, rapid growth, 59% year-over-year growth in the December quarter to 22.7 million, relatively small company still, just getting started. The thing that I think is interesting about this, Joe, is that they have put out preliminary guidance saying that their Q1 number is going to be about 30 million. So you're talking almost 50% sequential growth, and you're talking about 100% year-over-year growth. So I think Shockwave Medical is one that you want to have on the radar. Switching gears over to aerospace. This is a stock I don't own yet, but it's a stock I've coveted for a long time. and I'm more than likely going to pull the trigger on it. It's called TransDigm Group. TDG is the symbol there. You can see, Joe, it's been going pretty much sideways since November, around 600 plus or minus. Gonna earn $17.09 in 2022, up 50%. Sales are down year over year, but that's again because Boeing and Airbus had to slow down their production schedules because of problems that they've had, but also because of lackluster demand from airlines. If we assume that we're going to see travel pick back up again, then I imagine that the revenue at TransDigm is going to pick up as well. And this stock, given the base, I think that this stock could go markedly higher if it can clear the 625 area. So I think that if this clears 625, that would be where I would want to take it. I would take it. Actually, I might even take it right around here at 600 because I can define my exit pretty easily with that channel. A slightly different area, defense, small cap, Rada Electronic Industries. It's an Israeli company. They make, Joe, radar that can be used in like the desert to detect UAVs, so drones. So yep. Drone radar. Interesting company. I am long this one. Grew 62% year over year in the December quarter to 23 million. Earnings per share up, expected to be up 200% this year and 48% in 2022. And the symbol there is RADA, Rada Electronic. And then the last one I'll leave us with, Joe, is Chipotle.
Yeah. Good one.
Chipotle. So, I mean, this stock again has been going sideways pretty much since last, you know, August. And I think we've got a good opportunity here if it can get out of that 1565 to go markedly higher. 12% year over year revenue growth in the December quarter. Expected to have a big bounce back, obviously, with the easing of restrictions, COVID restrictions, going from $10.70 per share in earnings in 2020 to as much as $23.14, 116% growth theoretically in 2021 if they can deliver the goods this year. So I think that, again, this is a high scoring stock in our research that I think also has an interesting technical setup, and an argument can be made for tucking this one in the portfolio as well. So that would be, I think that's a pretty good smattering for this week.
Yeah, I think so too. So we will leave it at there. Stay optimistic, everybody. Spring is here, vaccines are coming, and we'll see you all next week.